central teachings of the Buddha is the understanding of no self. The fact that there is no solid entity that can be found and identified as I, mine, or myself. And all of the Buddha's teachings point to this truth in one way or another. Marcia and I have mentioned it throughout the last 3 weeks, either directly or indirectly. And the usual question that follows a statement like, there is no self, is, well, if there's no self, then who is it that's sitting here, that gets up at the end of the talk, goes to bed, gets up in the next morning and comes back to the hall, etc.? And this is a reasonable question that we might ask, because at this stage, very likely in our practice, the mind is still deluded into believing that this is me sitting here, that I am the one that's sitting and listening to this talk, that this is myself. But this is wrong understanding. This is the understanding that we're all working to completely overcome, because it's this wrong understanding that leads to all of the suffering that is in the world. It's out of this wrong understanding that this is me and that is you that sets up, I want this, I don't want you to have that. Create separation where none exists. And it's all born out of this clinging to the idea of self. And this doesn't mean that when there is delusion present in the mind, that there is a self, and that when wisdom is in the mind, there isn't a self. There is simply either wrong view or right view in the mind, either delusion or wisdom in the mind, but never an abiding solid entity that we can call myself. So when we hear this, we can see that we're not getting rid of anything. We're not going to lose the self. We're going to rather realize the truth of the way things are. And the Buddha did tell us not to simply accept his words at face value. He said it was for us to see for ourselves. One time he gave a new and deep teaching to his closest disciple at that time, who was Sariputta. And at the end of the teaching, he said to Sariputta, do you believe this teaching that I've just given you? And Sariputta replied, no, Lord, not yet. And the Buddha said, that's a good answer, Sariputta. And this is how it needs to be with us. We hear what the Buddha's teachings related to no self are, and then we chew over it. We work with it, we put it into practice, and then see for ourselves. And the seeing for ourselves is no mean feat. This is a difficult understanding to realize. So it's not to give ourselves a day or two to, you know, work with it for a little bit and then think that we're going to, you know, come to understand it overnight. They're deep, subtle, profound teachings. And at the same time, it's quite possible for every one of us here to come to know this truth. It's not out of our reach. So it's helpful then for us to begin with what we do feel. And that is that this is myself. So let's rather ask the question, if this is myself, then where is it? Or what is it? And when we ask this question, usually our response is something like, well, all of this is me, or sometimes we have the feeling that there's this little observer inside, or something like that. But somewhere within this agglomeration of mind and body resides this thing that we call self. But if this is so, then that would mean that we're in control, right? So let's take a look. Well, are we in control? Because we never look at this aspect of our lives very closely. We somehow take it for granted that this is me getting up at the end of the sit, going to bed. So we don't look very closely. But if we were in control, then why doesn't this body obey us? Why does it continue to get old when we would quite happily stay at the age of 50 or something? Yet, it, you know, year after year, it rolls on. The wrinkles grow. What about that uncomfortable feeling in the body? Why can't we rather have that pleasant sensation that we'd much prefer? Instead, we find that we're sitting with the pain in the neck, the back, or the knee, or anywhere else. Why, when we go to a movie, right in the middle of the, just when the plot's being revealed to us, we have to get up and go to the bathroom? This is the body. We actually have no control. But we don't think in this way. We think, oh, I've got to get up and go to the bathroom. I've got to do this. I've got to do that. But it's not about that at all. So contemplating in this way can slowly help to shake this calcified illusion of someone here behind experience. Someone there to whom experience is happening. So if this is where we're coming from, then let's take apart this person that we call myself. Let's take it apart and find this self. Where is it? Amongst many diverse examples related to the unraveling of this mystery of no self, this was one way that the Buddha worked with both the monks and the lay practitioners to help to allow for this understanding of no self to ripen. He would take apart this person that we call myself. And it's also the way the Venerable Nagasena worked with King Milinda when he was interested in this aspect too. So tonight I'm going to use this aspect of no self related to Venerable Nagasena and King Milinda to describe the very well-known story of the simile of the chariot. It's a very helpful and simple story that helps to support the breaking down of this deeply held concept of a self that keeps us bound to suffering. So there was once this very wise monk by the name of Nagasena. He was asked by a group of arhants to help them out with the very learned, intelligent King Milinda. King Milinda was also a very spiritual man, and so he knew some of the Dharma, and he was also a teacher in the Brahmanic tradition. But as the story goes, he had spent time with this group of arhants, and it seems that he would pester them with various questions on the Dharma, and when they would respond, then King Milinda would come back with a counter argument. And this would go on, and the arhants, these were fully liberated beings, they were getting a little tired of this. So they summoned the very wise Venerable Nagasena to help them out with King Milinda. So this is the story that I'm going to read, the whole story around this famous example of the simile of the chariot. And as I go through the story, you'll see that the questions that come up for King Milinda are very likely the same sort of questions that would come up for us related to this teaching on no self. So it's a very lively kind of thrust and parry debate. King Milinda arrives with his retinue, and the very wise Venerable Nagasena arrives with his retinue of monks. So here we have a very wise monk and a very intelligent, learned, and competent King Milinda. So they're meeting for the first time. And King Milinda asks Venerable Nagasena, he says, "How is your reverend known? And what is your name, sir?" And Nagasena replies, "As Nagasena I am known, O great king, and as Nagasena do my fellow religious habitually address me, but although parents give such names as Nagasena, or Surasena, or Virasena, or Sihasena, nevertheless, this word Nagasena is just a denomination, a designation, a conceptual term, a current appellation, a mere name. For no person can here be apprehended." And King Milinda replies to Venerable Nagasena, "If, most reverend Nagasena, no person can be apprehended in reality, who then, I ask you, gives you what you require by way of robes, food, lodgings, and medicine? Who is it that consumes them? Who is it that guards morality, practices meditation, and realizes nibbana? Who is it that kills living beings, takes what is not given, commits sexual misconduct, tells lies, and drinks intoxicants? Who is it that commits the deadly sins? For if there were no person, there would be no merit or demerit, no doer of meritorious or demeritorious deeds, no agent behind them, no fruit of good and evil deeds, no reward or punishment for them. If someone were to kill you, O Venerable Nagasena, he would not be committing murder. And you yourself, Venerable Nagasena, you would be no real teacher or instructor or ordained monk. You just told me that your fellow religious habitually address you as Nagasena. What then is this Nagasena?" So here are some of the examples that King Milinda offers. And what does he do? He goes through the 32 parts of the body. So he says, "Are perhaps the hair of the head, Nagasena?" And Nagasena responds, "No, great king." "Or perhaps the hairs of the body?" "No, great king." "Or perhaps the nails, teeth, skin, muscles, sinews, bones, marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, serous membranes, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, stomach, excrement, the bile, phlegm, pus, blood, grease, fat, tears, sweat, spittle, snot, fluid of the joints, urine, or the brain in the skull? Are these the Nagasena?" So notice there are only 32 parts here. There's no 33rd little part or microchip that we might call the self. Only 32 parts. So Venerable Nagasena replies and says, "No, great king, none of these is who I am." So then the king goes on, and now he comes up with the five aggregates. Then he says, "Oh, okay, is formless Nagasena, or feeling, or perception, or impulses, or consciousness, Nagasena?" And the Venerable Nagasena replies, "No, great king, The king goes on. Then is it the combination of form, feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness? No, great king. Then is it outside the combination of forms, feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness? No, great king. Then ask as I may, I can discover no Nagasena at all. Just a mere sound is this Nagasena. But who is the real Nagasena? Your reverence has told a lie, has spoken a falsehood. There really is no Nagasena. Then the very wise, venerable Nagasena asks the king a question. He says, great king, you are a very wealthy man, very well looked after, very refined. You had a long way to travel to meet me. Did you walk? Did you come on foot? Did you come on a mount? How did you get here? How did you get to this meeting? And the king replies, I did not come on foot, sir, but I came on a chariot. So now we have the simile of the chariot. So Venerable Nagasena then says, if you have come on a chariot, then please explain to me what a chariot is. Is the pole the chariot? No, reverend sir, says the king. Is the axle the chariot? No, reverend sir. Is then the wheels, or the framework, or the flagstaff, or the yoke, or the reins, or the goad stick the chariot? No, reverend sir, replies the king. Then is it the combination of the pole, axle, wheels, framework, flagstaff, yoke, reins, and goad, which is the chariot? No, reverend sir, replies the king. Then is this chariot outside the combination of the pole, axle, wheels, framework, flagstaff, yoke, reins, and goad? No, reverend sir, replies the king. Then ask as I may, I can discover no chariot at all. Just a mere sound is this chariot. But what is the real chariot? Your majesty has told a lie. He has spoken a falsehood. There really is no chariot. But then the very intelligent King Milinda thinks for a moment. And then he says to the Venerable Nagasena, I have not, Venerable Nagasena, spoken a falsehood. For it is in dependence on the pole, the axle, the wheels, the framework, the flagstaff, etc., that there takes place this denomination chariot, this designation, this conceptual term, a current appellation, a mere name. Then the Venerable Nagasena says, Your Majesty has spoken well about the chariot. It is just so with me. In dependence on the 32 parts of the body and the 5 aggregates, there takes place this denomination, Nagasena, this designation, this conceptual term, a current appellation, a mere name. In ultimate reality, however, this person cannot be apprehended. And with this, the king is thrilled with the response from Venerable Nagasena, because he now understands what this being is that we call I, me, and myself. So this methodical explanation shows us how we mistakenly solidify a series of causes and conditions into a self. But when we hear this story, it can make a lot of sense to us on one level, and it's helpful, but it's only on one level. The point of telling a story like this is to plant the seed in the mind to take a closer look. Because no matter how intelligent we are, even if we have an IQ of 199, that understanding of it intellectually isn't going to do it for us. So it's not that we tell stories like this to foster more thinking about it, but to challenge us to take a closer look by means of mindfulness, wherever we may be in our practice, to take a closer look. It's more that we're tantalizing the investigative mind, you could say, to take a closer look. So it's not so much that we now sink our teeth into the teachings on no self, more we sink our teeth into the practice of mindfulness. And that will reveal this truth to us. So we begin to take a closer look with the support of mindfulness and the investigative mind. So then let's take a look at a few aspects of practice where we might take a closer look, where we just don't take for granted certain aspects of our practice and how we move around here. And in this way, we might slowly help to shake this assumption of this is me and I am the doer behind actions. So let's take the example of this heater that goes on in the room every 15 or 20 minutes, depending on how hot or cold it is. When that heating system goes on, whether we like it or not, because we have an ear and the sound is within hearing distance, hearing is going to happen. There's an ear and a sound, and the result is hearing consciousness. There is nothing to do with me in that. If there was something to do with me in that, we would say, I'm not going to hear that sound. But that doesn't happen. The hearing happens. Or you might say, I'm going to hear that sound right now. And that can't happen. Why? Because the sound isn't happening. We may have the ear, but there is no sound to hit the ear, so there's no hearing consciousness. But we don't think in that way. The sound goes on and immediately is, I'm hearing that sound. Similarly with smelling. In the morning when Siri is cooking in the kitchen, if you have a room close by, you will have a pungent smell of garlic quite often. Why? Because there's a nose and a smell and they're contacting each other. Therefore, there's smelling consciousness. Causes and conditions. There is no me in there that's doing the smelling. As soon as we walk away, we walk out of the building, out into the road, that smell disappears. Because the smell is not contacting the nose. It's got nothing to do with, I can't smell this anymore. The conditions have changed. That's all that's happened. And similarly, with every other sense door that we have, a similar thing happens. But we don't think in that way. We're not looking, we're not investigating in a close way. Then let's take another example. Let's look at our walking practice. Let's say we're doing slow walking, lifting, moving, placing. Now, each of these examples I'm giving you, by the way, are ways that I myself have worked in this investigative way to discover what this mind-body process is all about. So let's take walking, for example. Let's say we're doing lift, move, place, and we're lifting our foot. So we've got one foot on the ground and one foot up in the air. Why can we not lift the other foot off the ground as well? Well, have you ever thought of it? I did. I was like really interested. Why can that not happen? The other foot, the foot that's on the ground, can only be lifted dependent on the other one being placed. It's dependent, the one is dependent on the other. There is no way walking can happen with both feet on the ground or both feet in the air. One needs to be lifted, moved, and placed. Once that's happened, the next one can be lifted, moved, and placed. Is that anything to do with me? No, it's causes and conditions. Dependent on this, that happens. Wrapped up in there too, of course, and with every other little movement we make, is intention. And I spoke about this in one of the reflections the other morning. So let's take a little look at intention. Play with this for a little bit. Let's say we're doing walking meditation, back and forth. Now, in my own practice, what I would do would be walk to the end where there may be a wall. And then I would say, well, I'm just going to continue walking right through that wall. But that doesn't happen. A condition has arisen. Turning is going to happen because a condition has arisen. And because that condition has arisen, an intention is going to arise to turn. So explore your practice in this way. Where is the intention born out of? There will be a previous condition. And that's going to happen with everything. So take a look. What is prompting this, the birth of this intention? It's not me. There will be a previous condition. It's too cold outside. It's too hot outside. Lunch has happened. We've reached the end of our walking strip. Something will have arisen, some condition. So this is another way that we can get closer to experience to actually see how causes and conditions are coming about, that it's not, I am not the doer of the action. Then let's take a look at eating. Eating's another area that we can explore. Let's say we're sitting in the dining room and we take a nice big bite out of an apple. So we've got a large chunk of apple in our mouth. Then try swallowing it immediately. Is this possible? Well, this is what I tried. This is what I practiced with. I had this chunk of apple in my mouth. And I'm like, okay, right, now swallow. And then I saw that, well, swallowing is dependent on chewing. Swallowing happens because chewing, you know, the solid lump has been completed. Then we swallow. Then I took another look. Okay, for example, in this room, nobody's chewing. Well, why not? No one's chewing because you don't have anything in your mouth. Chewing is dependent on having food in the mouth. So then you can take another look. Okay, you put a spoon of food in your mouth. Try immediately putting another spoon of food in the mouth. One right after the other. Well, we don't do that either. One mouthful goes into the mouth. It's then chewed. Once it's chewed, dependent on it being chewed, we swallow. Dependent on the mouth being empty, another spoonful is put into the mouth. And that will continue dependent on whether we're watching our experience from a place of greed. Is it motivated by greed, where we could just continue until we're bloated? Or whether we're eating from a place of wisdom, motivated by wisdom, which is this body needs to be fed to keep it alive so that we can practice. Okay, so you'll watch this, the who is the motivator, who is the intender, who is the eater. To just explore this way, it can be very helpful to begin to allow for hairline cracks to begin to develop in this solid view of me, the doer, doing things. It just helps. It may not take us all the way, but it helps to break it down, allow for these hairline cracks to form. Because all the while that we're investigating closely in this way, the mind is very close, it's watching very closely the unfolding of experience. And when we're doing this, what's happening? Concentration is developing. So here we've got mindfulness, investigation, concentration, all developing, allowing for the conditions to ripen in the mind for this deep insight to be seen very, very clearly. work in this way, it really brings the practice alive. It's not dull or tedious in any way. We really want to see, what is it? What is this mind-body process that feels like me doing it? So the investigative process, the investigative unfolding, is nothing to do with thinking at all. It's not about the thinking process. It's a little bit like if we have a bunch of keys in our hand and we're standing at a locked door. The thinking process would be to stand there with this bunch of keys in your hand and think, I wonder if this key will open this door. Or perhaps it's this key, but all the while we're thinking about it, which is not really very helpful. The investigative process would be to take a key, put it in the lock, and then turn and feel. So we're feeling from the inside, sensing, feeling, watching, close to the actual experience. That's what investigation is all about. That we're right there, kind of in touch, in contact with the unfolding experience. So as we continue in this way with the practice, when conditions ripen in the mind, the deep insight into the selfless nature of the unfolding experience shows itself. We see that it is just causes and conditions, this dependent on that, not a me doing the actions. And then when we see this very deeply, very clearly, the result of that is that we have no doubt in the mind. We don't wonder anymore, is there a self or isn't there a self? It becomes very deeply clear and established within us. In the same way, for example, that we don't have to think about whether the sky is blue. Is the sky blue? Isn't it blue? We know that it's blue. So there's no thinking about it. We simply know. The same thing happens once this deep insight has been established within us. Interestingly enough, sometimes this deep insight into the selfless nature of this mind-body process can arrive once we've left the retreat. We're at home, gone home, minding our own business, getting on with life, and suddenly the true nature of existence can creep on us up on us from behind when we weren't even looking for it. Why would that be? Very likely it's because we've relaxed. We've let go of trying. So what has happened is that we've been on formal retreat, which has been a very important part of the process. We've worked hard with our practice. All of the conditions have ripened, almost. And then we go home. Oh, we relax. We let go of this is me doing the practice. And because of that, we're at home running up the stairs and suddenly there's nobody that's doing it. Suddenly we see, oh, there's no one here behind the experience. So it can happen like this sometimes too. After the Buddha's Parinibbana, his attendant Ananda was the only one in the group that wasn't enlightened. And so there was going to be this big meeting of all the arhants, and they wanted Ananda to attend because he had a very good memory and he knew what all the Buddha's talks and suttas were. But everybody felt that it was important for Ananda to be fully liberated too. So there was a fair amount of pressure that he was under to get enlightened within the next 24 hours before the meeting was going to take place. So he was working back and forth, doing his walking meditation, really working hard, and he was getting really tired. No liberation, just really very tired. So he thought, oh, I'm going to take a break. I'm going to take a nap, lie down for a while. And just as he let go, as he lay down, he wasn't even on the lying down yet, just then, full liberation hit, just when he had let go. Not trying too hard. So there's a really wonderful message in here for us, because we can't force wisdom. We can't make it happen. all we can do is work at an even, consistent pace with sincerity, and those conditions will allow for the results to come when the conditions are ready. Sometimes we can have some misunderstandings related to this realization of no self, and it can be a little perturbing for some people. Sometimes people can think that, you know, we'll disappear into a kind of a gaseous mass, or a black hole, or fall off the edge of the earth, or something, that there'll be some unpleasant result. But that's not what happens at all, actually, because what changes is that it's just the wrong idea. That's what shifts for us. We go from the wrong idea of the way things are to the right idea of the way things are. So we might take a little example that can help for us to understand this wrong idea and right idea. So let's say, for example, we work 5 days a week, Monday to Friday. We take the train to work. Every morning we get up, we walk down to the station, we take the 9:20 train. So one Friday morning, we get up, we go down to the station, and we're waiting for the train, the 9:20 train. And we're waiting and waiting, and it doesn't seem to be coming. So we ask the person next to us, what's happened to the 9:20 train? And the person says, oh, it's not Friday today, it's Saturday. There's no 9:20 train on a Saturday. In that moment, what happens? It's not Friday, it's Saturday. We let go of something. In that moment, we've suddenly now got the right idea. We've gone from the wrong idea that this is Friday to the right idea that, now it's Saturday. So what else has changed? Nothing. Nothing else has changed other than the wrong idea to the right idea. And actually we sometimes feel a little lighter. The understanding, the realization of no self is a tiny bit like that. We've just gone from the wrong idea to the right idea. Of course, it's much bigger. We've let go of a big chunk of delusion. So, of course, it's transformative in our life. Whereas our day has been transformed from realizing that it's now Saturday and we've got the day off. It's not Friday and we have to go to work. When we have this transformative realization of no self, this big chunk of delusion is let go of, and so we view the world differently. So that really is deeply transformative. So we let go of a lot of the clinging that's been there. And this realization of no self, although it's now permanent, that wisdom will never again be turned into confusion. If it's deeply rooted, if it's deeply seen, we're not going to be confused again. So that realization is permanent. Yet it's not always in the forefront of consciousness. It's not always in the forefront of our minds. The Buddha was asked about this one time. Of course, he was asked about it in relation to full-blown liberation. Someone asked him, when you're fully liberated, is that understanding uninterruptedly in the forefront of the mind? And the Buddha said, no, it's not always present in the mind. One has to turn the mind to it, to review it. And then he gave an example. He said, if someone has had his hands and feet cut off, that understanding is not always in the forefront of that person's consciousness. That person needs to turn their mind to that realization. This was a very interesting example that he offered, I thought. So we need to turn the mind to it, and then it comes to the forefront of consciousness again. The understanding is there. Another misunderstanding that sometimes is in the mind when we don't understand fully this realization of no self, sometimes we think that we're going to end up being a hollow, kind of vacant person with no heart, no feelings, that people who are close to us, we won't feel loving feelings towards our family and our children and our friends. In fact, the opposite happens. We feel much more deeply connected, much closer, because there isn't this veil of separation of this is me and you, and there's much less clinging. So the heart is deeply connected. The separation has gone. One also feels a deep and genuine compassion for all beings, because we see that they're still rooted in the belief of a self and not working towards letting that go. And out of this, they're perpetuating the separation of me and you, this and that. So the heart is steeped in compassion as well, because we see that it's the separation that causes the greed, the fighting, the suffering in the world. But at this stage, of course, we're not fully enlightened. We've still got a lot of work to do. In the frequently mentioned phrase of the Buddha, "This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself," which is repeated through and through many of the Buddha's suttas. At this stage, what's happened is that we've come to the understanding of "this is not myself," just that part of the phrase. And that means we now have right view. But there is still the "this is mine" is still there, and "this I am" is still there. These are what are called the latent tendencies. They are kind of lie in the so-called the walls of the mind. There are no walls of the mind, but it's as if, of course, because there is still some grasping at the aggregates. The "this is mine" is the craving. They're still craving. You can see mine, it's mine, we're holding to something. And "this I am" is conceit or pride. And it's often described as "I am better than you," or "I am worse than you," or "I am equal to you." So these two parts of the phrase, "this I am" and "this is mine," these we work with all the way through to full liberation. So we've still got considerable work to do, and these are very tenacious. They can be there in very insidious ways. So we continue to work with a very kind of careful, ever more refined mindfulness, because these latent tendencies will pop up when conditions are right. So what might some conditions be for these latent tendencies to arise? One time the Buddha was talking to a group of his monks who, it seems, thought that they were fully enlightened. And the Buddha gave a particular teaching to them, a sutta, and it's quite a long sutta, but within this sutta he says words to this effect. He conceives himself as Nibbana. He conceives himself in Nibbana. He conceives himself as apart from Nibbana. He conceives Nibbana to be mine. He delights in Nibbana, priding himself in Nibbana. He conceives it with conceit. Why is that? because he has not fully understood, I say. So at the end of the Buddha giving this particular teaching to the monks, usually it says at the end, and the monks were thrilled and delighted and, you know, very happy with the Buddha's teaching. But at the end of this particular teaching, it says that the bhikkhus did not rejoice in the Buddha's words. And then if you look up to see why, it's because there was still pride within them. The Buddha had hurt their feelings. There was still pride. So this is where we continue to look. It's really very interesting because, interestingly enough, as wisdom grows within us, sometimes pride can grow along with it. Because we think, oh, I'm doing pretty well. I've got a lot of insight. But that's the mine and I. I am doing well. That's pride that's in there. So it's not to be embarrassed about it or judge ourselves. It's going to be there all the way to full liberation. The important point is that we need to keep seeing it. There was one rather interesting example of how pride manifests that kind of amused me. The story goes that there was someone who had done a lot of long retreats. This is in one of the Tibetan teachings. And in Tibetan teachings, they tend to do long retreats, like 3 years at a time. So this particular person had done quite a number of long retreats. And he was rather proud of himself and wasn't aware of it. And so he would say to various people something like, "The Buddha did only 6 years of practice, but I did 9. So there you go. You know, you can see this is completely missing the point. And so this is what we need to see it arising within us. The Buddha also spoke about it in terms of having pride related to our sila. You know, where we feel we're keeping the precepts. And, he was talking to the monks related to this. Of course, they keep 227. Because pride can creep in there insidiously. So this is what we want to see too. Yeah, priding himself on his attainment and priding himself on his virtue. Taking it as mine, I. So how does wisdom continue to grow in the mind, and how do we continue to see the dark areas in the mind, the areas that still have delusion in them? So we might take an analogy of light and dark to help to explain this for us. So when we first come to the practice, right at the very beginning, we do our first little bit of work, retreats. We might say that the light in the mind, the wisdom in the mind, is perhaps about the size of a match, a lit match. So let's say we've got that much light in the mind, that much wisdom in the mind. But then we continue to practice, we see where we're grasping and clinging and pushing away, and we continue to practice. And that light in the mind gets bigger, the wisdom in the mind grows. So it grows perhaps to the size of a flashlight. A small pen light, flashlight. And then we continue to do more practice, and then perhaps we've got a 20-watt bulb of wisdom in the mind. But then we keep looking. We keep seeing where we're grasping and holding on and identifying. Until at some stage, having done considerable work, we have this deep and transformative insight into the selfless nature of this mind-body process. And then let's say that the wattage in the mind, the light bulb in the mind, is now at 65 watts. So we're sitting within this light sphere of 65 watts. Okay? And it can be dazzling. We're there and, wow, you know, there's a lot of wisdom. No self. And, you know, we're getting accustomed to this. But then, as we get more accustomed to this, we begin to look kind of at the edges of that light sphere. And then suddenly we begin to see kind of dark things on the far side. It's almost like having just this little lamp on here and the rest of the lights off in this meditation room. At first the eye can't adjust, you know, there's just light here. But as the eye gets used to it, we can see further and further into the room, and it's like seeing further and further into the mind. And then we see these latent tendencies showing themselves, pride creeping up, and you know, the craving, the holding on, the craving, the subtle grasping. And so that's how we stretch the wisdom in the mind. We begin to allow for that light bulb to begin to grow stronger and stronger, until ultimately, as the Buddha tells us, at some stage, when conditions are right, that light bulb will be 100 watts, if that's the strongest we could have. And at that stage, then we would know, as he tells us, that done is what has had to be done. There is no more work for us to do. And at that time, we will know, because there will be no more suffering that we'll be experiencing. So that's how this wisdom begins to grow within the mind. So let's sit together for a few moments.